schlesische Ton. Auf die Rechte.
Der deutsche Spargelkult müsse enden.
Germany's beleaguered defense minister has temporarily dropped his PhD title.
Volkswagen ist eine Perle der deutschen Industrie. Und ich glaube, das kann man
nicht sagen. Ich weiß, wie viel Liebe dahinter steht. Wenn Glühweinstände aufgebaut werden, wenn Waffen...
Spargel-Weltmeister ist China, denn die bauen 60...
Hey, this is Ted. Welcome to Spaßbremse. I'm excited to bring you our first episode of the new year, and we're starting off with yet another very timely and important topic. This time, I'm speaking with Ezra Ozurek, who's a professor at the Faculty of Divinity at the University of Cambridge. She's the author of the recent book out just last year with Stanford University Press. It's called Subcontractors of Guilt: Holocaust Memory and Muslim Belonging in Postwar Germany. It forms a nice little trinity with the previous two interviews we've done, going back to Lauren Stokes talking about immigration in Germany, and then Daniel Marvecki on the history of German-Israeli relations. And this, in a lot of ways, combines those two themes to talk about how German guilt over the Holocaust and memory has intersected with the large Muslim German communities in the country, and how in many cases, as she says, the Holocaust guilt gets subcontracted to the Muslim communities, and there's this idea of imported anti-Semitism, or the idea that anti-Semitism in Germany has been mostly banished, and the majority of the anti-Semitism now is the result of immigrants, specifically Muslim ones. Of course, this is not backed up by the facts at all. About 80% of anti-Semitic crimes in Germany are committed by white Germans, and a number of Germans themselves will also say that the guilt and the memory culture has gone too far and it's time to talk about other things and get over it. But of course, those actual statistics and empirical facts do not get in the way of Germany's desire to, in many cases, blame immigrants for anti-Semitism in the country. This has been especially stark after October 7th and the Hamas attacks on Israel and then the resulting war in Gaza. For example, SPD president of Germany, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, has called on Arabs in Germany to distance themselves clearly from Hamas, as if it would not be sort of assumed that you were not a member of Hamas or not close to it, that they actually needed to demonstrate that they're different from it. Is a very high burden of proof to place on all Arabs in the country. Vice Chancellor and Economics Minister of the Green Party, Robert Habeck, has warned Muslims that their actual presence in Germany was conditional on them rejecting anti-Semitism, again placing Muslims with a much higher burden of proof than ethnic Germans. He said that Muslims could face deportation if they're anti-Semitic. Of course, no such threat would be leveled at ethnic white Germans. Parliament, the Bundestag, also debated a law where the CDU wanted to require applicants for citizenship to pledge support for Israel's right to exist. So just a short rundown of this sentiment, but you can see that this goes across the political spectrum and is very widespread in Germany. And this interview I found really fascinating because Professor Ozurek, she's an anthropologist, and she takes an ethnographic view of this and looks at some of the public intellectuals that discuss these topics, some of the educational programs that try to sort of cure anti-Semitism in Muslim communities, and also looks at some of the guided tours in order to educate Muslim communities about these topics, such as a program called Muslims in Auschwitz. It's really, really fascinating. She gets into a lot of these really granular details that I think some of the more big picture political histories miss, and I think everybody will be very interested in it. Just one final note before we get to the interview. I would encourage everyone to support us on Patreon at patreon.com/spaßbremse. That's spelled out with a double S. We'll also link to it in the show notes. We've got a lot of great new bonus episodes planned, And I'm also going to start do some writing, start doing some writing for the Patreon to give a little more bonus content out there. And that's, of course, in addition to our extensive archive of episodes. So please support us on there to keep the show going. And with that note, on to the interview with Professor Ezra Ozarek. Hey, everyone, and welcome to Spaßbremse. Got yet another fascinating interview for you here. This time I'm speaking with Ezra Ozarek, who is the Sultan Qaboos Professor of Abrahamic Faiths and Shared Values, the Faculty of Divinity at the University of Cambridge. So Ezra, thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for inviting.
We'll be sure to say that full title every time I refer to you. being a podcast about Germany, we have to always respect the academic title.
Yes.
And she's the author of a recent excellent book called Subcontractors of Guilt, Holocaust Memory and Muslim Belonging in Postwar Germany, out just last year with Stanford University Press. I would guess when you were writing it, you didn't know quite how timely it was going to turn out to be. And the theme here of how Holocaust memory is digested in Germany and how that relates to Muslim Germans within the country has become especially relevant, of course, in the wake of October 7th. And I'm thrilled to have her on the podcast to discuss this very important, yet, of course, very heavy topic. But luckily, there's this great book, which really dives into a lot of detail and really on the ground specifics of actually how Holocaust memory is used and deployed in German society, especially among immigrants. So while we start out, you know, we'll get into some of the details and the actual educational events and the classrooms and some of the tours that you really document very, very well in your book. But while we are in the intro here, could you tell me a little bit about what motivated you to link these themes of religious belonging to the political issues of German-Israel relations and Holocaust memory, and why you found it especially relevant while you were doing this work?
Well, I initially went to Germany to write a book about Germans who convert to Islam. And while doing that research, at the back of my mind, I was constantly thinking about, is it possible? And if it is possible, how would it be for a Muslim to become a German? I mean, of course, I know that it is not, they're not the same, a German becoming a Muslim versus Muslim becoming a German. But, you know, even if metaphorically, because in Germany, you know, even with citizenship, immigrants do not become Germans, right? It is quite different from the US, also different from the UK, that they do not define themselves as Germans, and other people do not see themselves as Germans. So, you know, people would remain as Turks, as Arabs, let's say. But recently,
I find this really striking when you speak with people, when you speak with Germans, they'll say, even if someone holds a German passport, they say, oh, well, they're Turkish or something. And then me coming from the US, they say, well, no, like they're German. Like, why would you say that? So, yeah, it is for people who haven't spent time in Germany, it's a really important point to drive home, is that difference in mindset is quite striking, like you said, compared to some of the Anglo countries and presumably some others.
Yes. And then people will still use terms like Ausländer, right? Like the outsider, you know, for people. Wow, they're third generation German. You know, what does it take? So that was the question that I was asking. So what does it take? Would it be possible to become a German? I mean, obviously, these kind of blood-based ideas are still around. It is, you know, about how you look, whatnot. But at the same time, the basis of modern German identity is that it is not racist, right? It is about getting over the Third Reich. And learning from the experiences of the Holocaust, having learned the right lessons from it, or like what Jasper wrote about, you know, the German guilt, how accepting the German guilt makes the new German society German, you know, that makes a new us. So then I thought, well, then can it be taking the memory of the Holocaust memory on your shoulders. Is that the secret? Can that be a way to German identity? And also, when I was doing my research, let's say in 2005, 6, 7, there are already these concepts of Muslim anti-Semitism, how Muslims are not interested in the Holocaust. Those discourses were coming into being, and there were lots of organizations being funded. So this was emergent. So that is how I decided to follow it. And in, I don't know, I guess 200, 300 pages, I am trying to understand if it is possible. If so, how, why not?
No, it's a fascinating approach. And could you talk a little bit about your choice of methodology for this? Because compared to some of the other interviews that we've done recently, which touch on the issues of Holocaust memory or immigration, the last two interviews we've done on the podcast have been a bit more of a political history or a diplomatic history, looking at government documents, looking at, from things from the foreign ministry or the, different ministries in Germany, and looking at these political changes through those kind of high level governmental policies. And you mostly take a very, very different approach here, sort of zooming in at what these programs designed to combat, what in Germany is called Muslim anti-Semitism, the programs of which there are quite a number that are designed to combat this. You actually go on the ground and really look at the minute details. And so we'll find, specifics of little speeches, specifics of plays or tours of Auschwitz and so on. Could you talk a little bit about why you found that to be the most appropriate type of methodology for this book?
Okay. So to start with, I'm an anthropologist. That is what I know how to do, ethnographic research. But, it is, of course, it is not just by chance. That is what I believe in. That ethnographic research, looking at these details and looking at the effects of these, big governmental decisions or big global events on individual lives. How do they affect them? And then how do these individuals speak or talk back to these major events? So that is where my interest lies. So I both wanted to look at what is this, what do people understand by Muslim anti-Semitism? More so, I got more interested with the idea that Holocaust education specific for Muslims. That really puzzled me. I was like, wow, isn't Holocaust education? Do we have one for Vietnamese people? Do we have one for Polish people? I really couldn't wrap my mind around it. And I said, I have to go and see these. Like, what are they doing? More importantly, I also wanted to see how the people who these programs are aimed for understand what motivates them, because these programs are voluntary. They are not by force. They're extracurricular. Why do people attend to them? And I also realized that a lot of people who kind of organize and run these events are also Muslim. What does it take? What do they understand? How does it reconcile their German and Muslim identities? So I had to go and spend a lot of time with these people, lots of young people. What really was really life-changing, in a smaller sense, was when I went to Duisburg and observed this Muslims in Auschwitz event. It was just this, spend a lot of time with an amazing group of young men in their late teens, early 20s, went to their homes, hang out with them in cafes, cafes and bars where, motorcycle gang groups spent time, went to mosques with them. I thought only within the context of their lives, I could understand what these training programs mean. And that is what I tried to tell in the book.
And as a whole and sort of in aggregate, you talk about what I found to be kind of the most important themes or theses, at least in my reading of the book, One is in the title. It's the subcontracting thesis. And the other is the import-export theory of anti-Semitism. Could you talk about each of those in turn, the idea of subcontracting guilt, and then the import-export theory as you describe?
So this is the export-import theory. You know, so until late 1990s, early 2000s, there is no concept of Muslim anti-Semitism. You know, maybe there are some people who talked about it, but it is not in, you know, public circulation. There is definitely no education programs, anti-Semitism prevention programs designed for Muslims. And on top of it, anti-Semitism is seen in the framework of racism. There is not much effort to distinguish anti-Semitism from racism categorically. Of course, there is, you know, sufficient academic work that focuses on only anti-Semitism. But from early 2000s, there is a lot of work about that. And that comes into being at the intersection of multiple events in which what is the order of importance? You know, I think different people can have different views, but that can go from, you know, 9/11 to Second Intifada to rise of right-wing governments in Israel to establishment of the European Union and looking for a cultural foundation for itself as it moved from being the European Economic Community to a union, you know, so that it couldn't just be the interests, but they said coming to terms with the Holocaust will be our common thing that brings us together. I don't know, change of citizenship law in Germany. You can list a number of events. You know, so there has been this new emphasis that there is an old anti-Semitism that is kind of Nazi, an older anti-Semitism too, like this, that white right-wing German anti-Semitism, and there is a new one that is held by the Middle East, and it is motivated by anti-Israeli feelings. While recognizing it, Germans, because of the Holocaust memory culture, I don't know, and maybe rightly so, they were not willing to give a large credit on anti-Semitism to another group, namely Muslims. So they came up with the theory that anti-Semitism is mainly a German and, you know, Christian European invention. I'm not going into what I'm thinking about this idea. You know, there can be different ideas, but that is the public narrative. But then this idea has been exported to the Middle East through German missionaries and also Nazis who have been collaborating with some Arabs, you know, while they were, you know, during the First World War, trying to motivate them against the British and also into the Second World War. So that is how anti-Semitism came to the Middle East, the argument goes. And then, you know, the Second World War happened, it ended, Germany was denazified, and this anti-Semitic Nazi ideology came to an end in Germany. It has been struggled with. I mean, no one would say it had disappeared, but at least this argument requires the idea that there has been a successful coming to terms with it, which we can agree to some extent, but not perfectly. And then anti-Semitism has been imported from the Middle East to Germany, because this import thesis assumes that didn't exist in Germany anymore, right? You know, like something that you don't have comes from outside. So that, and if you look at the speeches of politicians, you will see this imported idea a lot. So it is as if this is a kind of anti-Semitism that doesn't belong to Germany. And also there's a lot of words associated with shame, that it is shameful. We're ashamed that this is here, but at the same time, it doesn't belong to here. So we need to even deport these people, right? You know, the idea of deporting them came into being, especially after October 7th. We heard Olaf Scholz say it, and then we had heard, you know, AfD had these ideas, but they're not limited to AfD. Maybe AfD talks about doing it in mass terms. So in a sense, we are sending back what has come here without us being wanting it. So that is that idea. And then subcontracting the guilt came is based on this idea, or that is how I follow the public discourse. So you need to take this guilt on your shoulders as a German, Holocaust of the guilt, to create a new us, a new Germany that, you know, could become part of the modern world, right? Could become a respectable member. That proves that it learned from its mistakes. But if you have come to this country after the Second World War, and if your father or grandfather have not committed this guilt, how are you going to share this guilt onto your shoulders and learn from it and show that, you know, you don't think like that anymore? So in an ironic way, this learning process or Holocaust memory was quite an ethnic idea. And it was based on, as an ethnic group, we own this. So it was not a universal idea, even though the teaching is universal, it is anti-racist or anti-Semitic. But in practice, it was us, white Germans, who have committed the Holocaust against the Jews, come together. So when people came after the war into this country from Turkey, from Yugoslavia, from other countries to rebuild the country after the war, they were not integrated into this Holocaust memory culture. Obviously, these people have thought about the Holocaust, you know, as you are coming to a country that is really, really mean or has been really, really mean to outsiders. How are you not going to think about it, right? You know, there has been lots of reminders of what had happened. First, reminders that are from those times, lots of discussions, and then after, tons of memorials to it. But when I talk to people who were children in Germany in 1980s, 1990s, they told me that the teachers kind of discouraged them to think about it. You know, there were some teachers who told them, oh, honey, this is not your thing. You know, now we're going to think about it. And that the homework is that ask your grandfather what they were doing during the Second World War. But you don't have to do this homework. You know, why don't you do something else? And some more politically engaged teachers would say, why don't you learn about what Turks did to Armenians, what they're doing to Kurds, or not do anything at all? You know, so in a way, there was no window for them to enter into this discourse. If it is the new German us happens like this, how are they going to enter into it? But then suddenly in 2000s, by these ideas of export-import anti-Semitism, they came to the center of it. Suddenly, they were the anti-Semites. There was the idea that, you know, after the German unification, after the establishment of the memorial to the murdered Jews of Europe, after this repayment or reparations to former slaves of the Third Reich, there was the idea that, okay, not absolutely Germany got over it, but there was this increasing sentiment that, okay, now we did a lot. We spent all that money. We, you know, for a few generations, we have repeatedly learned about it. And can we just become a normal country? Can we just get over it a little bit? And at that time, you know, also research, statistical research shows us that. I don't do that kind of research, but there is research. People wished that it comes to an end, you know, that we talk about the Holocaust too much. Those kinds of sentiment was on the rise. And at the time, I argue the guilt of anti-Semitism is passed on to the Muslim shoulders. You know, okay, not completely, right? You know, there are tons of Germans still in Germany who feel guilty. They think Germans should be, you know, be coming to terms with it. And then you can also explain this kind of unconditional commitment to Israel also through that. But arrival of the Muslims to the scene really helped that sentiment. So some of it could be shared by Muslims. So in that, the weight on the German shoulders could be lighter. You know, so we can say some of the guilt has been subcontracted to them. So this discussion can continue. There can still be lots of money can be spent on anti-Semitism, Holocaust education, but now directed at Muslims. And at the same time, a number of Muslim actors have emerged. They saw that, I mean, I'm not saying they're doing it just like opportunistically, but they also went through this education. And as Muslims, they also see and understand how vile anti-Semitism is. So they volunteered, you know, again, metaphorically, to subcontract that guilt. They said, okay, we will take this on our shoulders. We will show that how we also feel really bad about it. What are the kinds of lessons that we have learned from it? We will do this education, Holocaust memory, even better than you. And in return, will you accept that? Accept us to the German us? Can we become also part of it? Will you then accept a society, a German society that is more diverse and different, you know, than just white ethnic Germans? So that is the story.
You use this great term, the emotional social contract in the Federal Republic. And I think what you've just described is they place people of Muslim background in Germany. Their role within that emotional social contract has changed. In both cases, they've been excluded. But you described this earlier period when it was just sort of like, well, this isn't, you're not really a part of this. Yeah, you don't have a grandpa that was in the Wehrmacht or whatever. It's just not quite relevant. And then it seems like after 2000 and the series of events that you described, now rather than just being outside of this emotional social contract, they're now seen as almost directly in opposition and needing to redeem themselves in order to be in there. And it's like, well, you could join it potentially if you repent enough, but unless you repent, you're seen actually not just as outside of it, but actually an opponent of it. And there's you talk about a kind of surprising willingness for Muslims in Germany to actually really try hard to become part of this and actually sort of scour their souls for anti-Semitism and try to actually get beyond this. And it's interesting because it's not as rejected as whole cloth as you might think. You know, people actually do want to become German, and they recognize that they need to become part of this contract. And it's very difficult, even with all the efforts that you document, to actually be let into that.
Right. I mean, granted, I have been to Germany since October 7th, but I didn't have a chance to revisit these education programs, these young people. I am really curious what kinds of new sentiments came into being. But definitely before this war, they were really committed to understanding anti-Semitism. They were very committed to studying the Holocaust, you know, all these trips to Auschwitz, to memorials. It is not difficult for them to understand. For example, this one scene that really stayed with me. I went, you know, with a group of Muslims to Auschwitz, and we spent a lot of time in what is called Auschwitz One. If you have been to it, at the end of it, there is a part that shows like these family photographs that shows the life before the Holocaust. You know, so I realized that they're really looking at the photographs, they're talking about it. And then I started, you know, like that's how I do. I listen and I ask questions. So they told me that they're really taken by, you know, like boys doing their bar mitzvahs, these families, they look German, but they're a little bit darker. You know, so many of them said they're really affected. And then they felt like in these photographs, people look like them. It could be their families. You know, they are also the German, but they're a little bit different. They have their really different religious rituals. So in that sense, it is not difficult at all for Muslims in Germany to connect to Jews in Germany, you know, especially before the Holocaust, or if they have opportunities now, you know, without talking about, without the stress of the Middle East, they can really understand each other. Also, by talking about anti-Semitism, they see a way to talk about racism and Islamophobia in Germany, because it is quite difficult to talk about other forms of racism in Germany, especially about Islamophobia. But they use it as an opportunity. They kind of need to first prove that they're anti-Semites and they understand how it damages society. And from there, they find a, you know, genuine and sophisticated way of talking about other forms of racism. So that I see is kind of a motivation for them. And they really wish for a new Germany where there is, you know, no place for racism, for any of it.
Yeah. And you talk about at times, though, the Muslim kids, you know, really identifying with the plight of Jews during the Holocaust, and then some ethnic German teachers being extremely livid at them and saying, no, you know, you're not supposed to empathize with the victims. You're supposed to empathize with the perpetrators. And this gets into one of the first kind of examples I have where I have first talking about the public intellectuals and then moving on to some of these school and nonprofit activities. And then finally, the third one being these tours that you alluded to. And the first one on public intellectuals, there's sort of two broad categories of them. One are people of Muslim background who sort of take it upon themselves to be the ones to lecture people, to either lecture Muslims about how to behave or explain Islam to the broader German society. And then there's also ethnic German public intellectuals who claim to be experts on anti-Semitism. But in the first category, there's a quite well-known figure, Ahmad Mansour, who says, quote, "Muslim kids must understand that they are not victims, but perpetrators." You know, a really striking thing. And it stands in complete contrast to actually how you describe some of the kids feeling in these exercises and experiences. So could you talk a little bit about the role of public intellectuals in this process of subcontracting?
Yeah, I mean, this is not unique to Germany. We have it in other West European countries also. These Muslim brokers, we can say, they are experts. They claim the role of expertise and they talk to white Germans, let's say, and to policymakers. And I think to get the recognition that they get from the, you know, white educated public audience, they make up a Muslim society that doesn't really exist. I mean, I quite was shocked reading books by Ahmed Mansour, Seyran Ateş, who are some others. Sorry, some other names are escaping my mind now. I mean, of course, there are lots of genuine scholars who write, you know, really good books, but they're not the ones that get a lot of attention. And many of these people also get lots of attention from right-wing movements that they get quoted there. In the Dutch case, for example, Ayan Hirsi Ali would be a really good example of this. They half fabricate a story about Muslims that are not real, but on the basis that they're speaking as a Muslim about Muslims, they get a lot of credit. If they are a female, if they're a woman, this story will always be that they were really sexually controlled in their society, and then they escaped. And by entering into the German realm, they got freedom. And when we look at their lives, they really wasn't so, you know, like none of these women who were writing such things were not exactly sexually so oppressed. They actually come from, you know, moderately liberal families. And if they're men, like the case of Ahmed Mansur, they claim that they were in the hands of extremist terrorist organizations. And then by meeting Germans, they opened up their minds. And again, this is not the case. You know, we have no evidence that any of them were, like, you know, in terrorist extremist organizations. So it always comes with a story of liberation. And they, come up with really exaggerated stories about Muslims. You know, fine, I guess they make a living, they make fame for themselves, but then it becomes quite costly for the Muslims. Then, you know, stories about themselves that are not real are circulating. And then these programs sometimes rely on their teachings. And then some of them feel like they need to come up with these stories. You know, so Ahmed Mansur is, in a way, imitating the German narrative, right? The Germans were perpetrators, and that is how, you know, through confessing it, it's also a Christian story, redemption came. So he shows that if Muslims also accept themselves as perpetrators, then they can want redemption. And they can do what Germans had done. So he says, you know, today's Muslims should bring the 1968 movement to themselves. He equates contemporary Muslims with 1968 movement Germans. Then he draws a path. You know, if you walk on this path, you will be accepted. He draws a path, but at the same time, he depicts a perpetrator Muslim society that it is not. You know, there can be many problems in German Muslim societies, but they're not Nazis. You know, they didn't, do the Holocaust.
Yeah, there's this very the sort of temporal, the implied temporality here is very interesting to me, where it's like you need to in both the idea of like patriarchy and gender relations and anti-Semitism. There's this idea that. That Germans have moved beyond all of this and the Muslim communities in Germany are sort of stuck in the like early Federal Republic era where they're still anti-Semitic, they're still patriarchal. Germany progressed beyond all of that. Mm-hmm. And it's like you said, you can just follow this path and you can do the same thing. And it's this very, it's interesting because these arguments, they don't match on to a certain kind of like right-left political spectrum or a specific parties as much as you would think. Like you said, the far right has use for these narratives because it's a way to stigmatize Muslims. But there's also this weird use from a sort of putting in air quotes, like progressive lens too of like, oh, well, you know, we're so against anti-Semitism. We're so in favor of women's rights. You know, obviously that's very good, but they say, oh, well, we have to kind of stigmatize these Muslim communities because they're against these things. And so you can have a kind of Islamophobia of both the left and the right in Germany, which I find very, very alarming and, you know, not wholly unique, but really, really, yeah, like I said, concerning to see.
Yes, and then it also, it reflects itself in these post October 7 discussions as well, too. You know, that from both sides, Muslims are stigmatized and that they are not given space to air out their grievances.
Yeah. And the second point that I want to cover here that you look into extensively are these educational programs on Holocaust history and anti-Semitism. You mentioned them a little bit at the start. And, you know, again, one of the one of the main things that comes back over and over is that the Muslims are supposed to identify with the perpetrators and they identify with the victims. We talked about that in other contexts as well. Yeah. And that is another recurring thing in these types of programs. You really look into, it's called the Heroes Organization. And there's this very sort of strange theatrical role playing in an imagined patriarchal society. And you know, this idea that all women in Muslim communities are being oppressed and they sort of need to free themselves. And you talk about, in reality, there's a lot of households are led by women. And so some of the participants in these programs and these sort of plays, like acting out these gender relations that they didn't observe in reality. And the participants would be like, this is totally unrealistic. What's going on here? So could you, and also the idea of forced marriages were seen as very unrealistic. Could you talk a little bit about these educational programs, you know, kind of more broadly, and then specifically this this like role playing exercise that I found fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there is a lot of sexism in German society overall. Actually, going to Germany from the US, I was pretty surprised, especially by how sexist and patriarchal academia is. It is just, I guess, sexism reflects itself differently in different societies. So like the different ones come out quite strongly. And there is also a lot of sexism in, you know, Turkish-German communities. There is no denying that. And it would, I think, be fantastic if all young men all around the world were given a chance to think about masculinity. I think, you know, so in that way, I'm not saying that it's a horrible program. But what it does is that it first, you know, there are these stereotypes about Turkish Germans and Muslim Germans. And these kinds of projects first builds these stereotypes, and they teach them to the young men, and then they show them how to counter them. So again, research by some other anthropologists show that Turkish German or Arab German youth also, when they think about their culture, you know, they want to learn about their culture, and they also rely on stereotypes. You know, so of course there is patriarchy. Of course, there is, you know, importance of brother over the sister, that the idea that the father is the, I don't know, the king in the family, whatnot. But in practice, it is not so. But when they are stereo, you know, that is how stereotypes work, right? You know, like they start with some truth, they make it bigger, and they make it as if it is absolute. So in these programs, these boys learn about these stereotypes and then act out stories, theatrical plays, where they go against these roles.
You talk about it in a sort of Freudian terms about, you know, rebelling against the father and like the sort of like having to overcome the patriarchal, the backwards patriarchal norms of the father. And
exactly. And there I also follow this argument of treating Muslims as if they are, you know, these backward Germans, as if they are the Nazis who did not repent, how Germany would look like if the 1968 had not happened. Because the idea, some of the common ideas are like that. Why did, you know, research done in 1960s in the US and also in Germany, what went wrong with Germans? How did this great nation of thinkers and philosophers and poets turn into Nazis? And then, you know, the social psychological approach argued that it is because of their families. It is because they had these fathers who are really oppressive and also absent at the same time. Also, you know, another popular argument, Nazis became violent because they were sexually oppressed. But again, the research shows that they were not sexually oppressed. Actually, Nazis were having sex all the time, right? You know, they were trying to create these healthy, natural babies. They just saw some forms of sexuality as bad as, you know, Jewish sex, and that some are like good Aryan sex. You know, so these programs that are designed for Muslims imagines them as if they are Nazis. So the idea that they need to sexually liberate themselves, then they will not be violent, they will not be anti-Semitic. It is, you know, the authoritarian family structure where the fathers are oppressive and absent. So if we change that, they will again not be anti-Semitic. I mean, it is, yeah, parts of it are just bizarre.
It is strange too. There's a few different examples of like irony that I picked up here. One is that you have these pretty conservative Germans then saying, you know, we need sexual liberation and we need 1968 to happen to the Muslim communities. And these are people who would have been horrified by like actual 1968. Yes. And so I find that a bit strange. And then there's also this idea that, you know, Muslim society is patriarchal. It's all, you know, all about men and it's so dominant, but all these programs are directed at men. And so it's like men are the only ones given agency, even as they're trying to overcome the patriarchy here. And it's like, you haven't really resolved the problem of male centeredness. And then it's also like, you know, you need to go sexually liberate yourself. And it's a strange form of saying like, you need to go try to sleep with as many women as possible, which is also not necessarily like a super egalitarian gender norm in its own right. It's like the contradictions within these educational programs seem really profound.
Yes, right. Looking from today, we know that if people have a lot of sex, that they are not aggressive, right? As if it is like this 1968 idea, make love, not war. You know, the world doesn't work like that. They also, yeah, feel a bit naive. But again, I think the idea behind it is that what did the Germans do? They rebelled against their fathers who were Nazis. You know, what did the students do? They went ahead and slapped their teachers and they left their parents. So there's a lot of emphasis. Leave your parents. You know, again, symbolically, I feel like there is the argument that leave your fathers who claim authority over you. If you leave that, then there is the promise that you may be accepted into the German contract. So kind of leave your Turkishness, leave your Arabness, leave any allegiance to that group. Then we may accept you. But of course, they are never accepted. For example, there were these killings in a shisha bar in Germany. Is it Hanau, I think? I was talking to these young men and they were saying, of course we go to shisha bars because we would never be accepted into other nightclubs, right? You're a young man, you know, you don't want to stay at home. You want to hang out with your friends. If you're a white man, you are accepted into these, you know, nightclubs where young people spend time. But if you're like, maybe if you go as a single young Arab man, you have higher chances. But if it is three of you, there is no way you will be let in. Then, of course, they go to shisha bars.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And very, very like logical for people to congregate, but then, get stereotyped and persecuted based on that. I mean, you see this all the time in Berlin, where there's just like these constant like raids of shisha bars and spätis and so on. This always this argument that there's like these tax evasion problems and stuff. But when you see people getting marched out of their, you know, their shisha bar and, you know, arrested or harassed by the cops, it's hard to think that that's purely just for the financial concerns of the Finanzamt is motivating the right. raids that go right. on in Neukölln.
Right.
And so the third main category that I found really fascinating is trips, different types of trips. You have like this Muslims in Auschwitz program. So really of taking, you know, Muslim Germans and going to Auschwitz in Poland. And then there's also some visits to Israel itself. But starting now with the Auschwitz trips, you talk about it as a sort of supposed to have a kind of purifying effect as a pilgrimage. And again, this idea of wanting to belong to the emotional social contract, you really feel that among some of your subjects where they express, you call it a strong desire to feel strong emotions and do this emotional performance. And they're really nervous that they won't feel the right thing and they won't act the right way. I empathize with that a lot. you know, having visited there just once several years ago, but being like, wow, this is like it. This is like, you know, maybe the worst place there, you know, the place where one of the worst things ever happened. Mm-hmm. And then you're like, what if I don't feel the right way? I mean, I did end up being very moved by it, but that idea of like, you know, emotional performance, really resonated. And so could you talk a little bit about both what these trips are supposed to do, and maybe what they actually do in terms of, you know, mm-hmm. how the participants actually feel?
Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, Auschwitz turning into this pilgrimage space is, you know, independent of what is happening with Muslims.
So Elon Musk was there last week, I think.
Oh, really?
His anti-Semitic comments. Then he did this too. So the this pilgrimage thing is really yes. widespread. You talk yes. about like Chelsea football fans. Also, if they expressed anti-Semitism, they'd be like, ah, well, we won't cancel your season tickets as long as you go to Auschwitz. It's very 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 strange.
Exactly. You know, there is this expectation from Auschwitz that it is supposed to cleanse you. It is supposed to transform you. You know, especially if you're a hopeless case, you know, that is the, you know, last hope to transform you. So that is happening. That also, I would say, it is kind of the emotional nature Holocaust education has taken, that it is, a lot of it is seen as the Holocaust had happened because of wrong emotions, because people couldn't empathize with Jews, you know. So it is not increasingly less emphasis on, you know, how fascism works, how it was about borders, how it was about, I don't know, capitalism and the weapons industry came together. You know, you can approach how the Third Reich came into being from different perspectives, but there's a lot of emphasis on it was the lack of empathy. People didn't say no. If they had the right emotions, it wouldn't have happened. So I see that
Total individualization of the thing, yeah.
Yes, and a sentimentalization of it too, in a way. So because it is like that, it puts so much pressure, especially on Muslims when they go to Auschwitz. So, you know, the first night I was there with this group of young men, I mean, obviously they chose it to go through this education. They chose to go to Auschwitz. They clearly care about it. They've thought about anti-Semitism for months to come. But right before sitting there, they went round and round. What if I don't feel the right things? What if I don't cry? What if it doesn't affect me? What is going to happen? And then, you know, when a friend asked this one boy who was really distraught, you know, to support him, what is the worst thing can happen? You know, just relax a little bit. He said, well, then it will be a proof that I'm an anti-Semite. It was the Nazis who couldn't empathize with Jews. And if I come here, see these, what happened to victims, and I cannot empathize, then it means I'm an anti-Semite, right? You know, like that was a genuine fear. And of course, there was no one that is untouched. You know, they, of course, were really heavily influenced by what they have seen. Yeah, but it is just to observe the emotional pressure on them was really remarkable for me.
Yeah. I mean, you even talk about a real kind of perverse event is some of the actual local Poles harassing these groups of Muslims. And so these, you know, intersecting sort of, you know, nesting dolls of guilt and perpetrator and victim. I mean, really, like, really wild episode there.
It happens quite common, you know, like visible Muslims do get harassed by locals in Poland.
Yeah.
I mean, when they're visiting Auschwitz.
Mm-hmm. And now sort of coming to the present moment, and you ask, you know, in your final chapter, if it's possible to, as you say, flip the script on Muslim anti-Semitism, mm-hmm. and you leave that as a question mark. What are your thoughts on how memory culture might evolve in Germany. I mean, because now we see just last week with this new law getting passed that would allow for dual citizenship, make it easier to become a German citizen. So the legal barriers to, you know, literally becoming German, having a German passport, are kind of falling away. And I'm curious what will happen as a result that, you know, will sort of memory culture and this emotional social contract, as you say, will that become more open and inclusive, or will we actually see that become more rigid as a response because there's fewer legal barriers, the actual kind of emotional and memory historical barriers will have to get stronger. I mean, I think there's probably some evidence for each, but with all these speeches by politicians and some states even saying, you know, if we sniff any anti-Semitism in your background, you know, you won't be allowed to become German, or Habeck saying in a famous speech that, you know, Muslims' presence in Germany was conditional on them rejecting anti-Semitism openly, you know, something that no ethnic German is made to do. I'm curious your thoughts on this moment, because it seems like a really remarkable confluence of events with this this new immigration law being passed, you know, right after October 7th, and the sort of rise in this, you know, in the mm-hmm. in the sort of the subcontracting mm-hmm. argument surfacing.
Yeah, I mean, I think in the short run we will see that memory culture becoming more rigid, because in the same law, I have seen that people also need to accept their commitment to the protection of Jewish life. You know, so they didn't say commitment to Israel, but that also includes Israel. So in that we see a more rigid definition of memory culture, rigid in the sense that it is about Germans protecting Jews, rather than, you know, for example, you can take a more universalistic understanding of the memory culture and say, you know, it is against any majority oppressing any minority, or you can take it very narrow, Germans versus Jews. So now we see the narrow definition getting stronger, all these Palestinians or pro-Palestinian voices having no say, you know, no space for even to air these ideas, that we are observing that. But at the same time, in the long run, it doesn't look that attainable. As you include more and more, you know, people with different backgrounds will become Germans and live there. And then at the same time, I do feel like this will feel oppressive also to a number of Germans. So I feel like in the long run, the memory culture will be more flexible, is my hope.
Yeah, that would be definitely something I'm hoping for as well, for this to loosen up here a bit. Well, Ezra, thank you so much for coming on Spaßbremse. It was a really fascinating conversation. And before we leave the interview, any concluding thoughts or any tips for where people can find your work and follow anything else you might be working on?
Well, please read my book.
Yes.
And yes, I'm easy to find. If you have any comments, write to me.
Great. Yes, we'll definitely link to the book. I encourage everyone to read it. Really opened my eyes a lot to get some of these really the specific examples that you get through this ethnographic approach in a way that differs from a lot of the other writing on this subject. So again, thank you so much. And thanks for listening, everybody. Cheers.